So welcome to another episode of our mini-series, Can the Record Be Trusted? My name is Ulrike Lühr, and I'm joined today by Natalia Gladkova, who is the Ukraine Archive Program Manager at Mnemonic. Mnemonic is, you might have heard about already, it's a global organization that supports human rights defenders in using especially digital human rights documentation with a view to advocacy, justice, accountability, and similar goals. Welcome and thank you for joining us, Natalia.
Thank you so much, Ulrike. Thank you for having me today.
So maybe for a start, could you tell us a bit more about Mnemonic? What does the organization do with regards especially to records and documentation, of course? And what do you do specifically in Ukraine as well?
Absolutely. Mnemonic is a human rights organization that works in conflict settings, including Ukraine, to make sure that digital open source evidence of abuses isn't lost or manipulated. We collect, preserve, and verify online content so it can be later used for advocacy, journalism, or legal accountability. So altogether, we host more than 30 million digital records. And Mnemonic runs four standalone archives. The best known is the Syrian archive, founded by Hadi Al-Habib over a decade ago to document human rights abuses and violations in Syria. Alongside, we also have Sudanese archive, the Yemeni archive, and Ukrainian archive. In addition, we also run a rapid response program that acts as an incubator for new archives and other conflict situations. And Ukrainian archive grew out of this rapid response program in February 2022, after a coalition of Ukrainian human rights organizations asked for help with documentation of alleged gross human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law linked to the Russian aggression in my home country. And since June 2024, I have joined Ukrainian Archive as a program manager, and our archive today holds over 7.6 million records showing the impact of the whole-scale invasion of the Russian Federation in Ukraine.
Wow.
So my role here is to make sure that material we collect together with Ukrainian human rights organizations is both secure and usable by accountability actors, NGOs, civil society organizations in Ukraine, and international media and local media as well. So we monitor and then strategically archive open source data. And we also conduct confidential investigations at the request of war crime units, UN fact-funding missions, special rapporteurs and human rights, OSCE, Moscow mechanism, and other international and national justice actors. At the same time, we also carry out public-facing investigations, including OSINT, in cooperation with international, national, and regional media on complex accountability issues. I think briefly, it's what we're doing together with Ukrainian civil society organizations.
Brilliant. Thank you. Those are obviously very impressive numbers in terms of the records that you have. And can you tell us a bit more? So you mentioned open source investigations, confidential investigations, or since sort of what kind of records are we talking about here? Like, what does it look like in practice? And then how do you, you know, restore, investigate, and archive this kind of documentation?
Yes. So like, we're talking about satellite images, we're talking about data that could be found on social media. And for Ukrainian archive, one of the most reliable and the sources of information is Telegram channel. So it's created by the Russian IT specialists, social media, and the materials from Telegram make around 90% of all the data captured within Ukrainian archive, but we also collect data from Facebook, from TikTok, from Twitter, like X, sorry. And there are more than 10 different social media platforms, websites, official information. And we have around 12,000 sources of material, open source materials. And Mnemonic has an in-house software that allows us to collect and capture material at risk of disappearing. For example, social media posts or videos that might later be deleted. Secondly, we archive. We store the material in a secure and searchable database with all the necessary metadata. And it can also serve as a reliable evidence in the future and trials. and lays likely goals to investigate, we verify where and when a piece of content was recorded and linked to broader patterns like attacks on civilians, attacks on civilian infrastructure, forcible displacement of children, environmental damage, and etc.
And you're mentioning the searchable database. So can anybody sort of search this database and also access this documentation? I imagine a lot of it is very sensitive and you might not want to. There's also privacy concerns involved.
Yes, of course. At this moment, Ukrainian archive is not open to general public. As you mentioned, rightfully, it contains sensitive material, metadata, and personal data. But it is accessible under collaboration agreements with trusted partners, like UN bodies, human rights investigators, journalists, legal teams, both Ukrainian and international. So we sign collaboration agreements. We train our partners how to access data because it requires a little bit of technical understanding and training. And the purpose is to balance two things. On the one hand, to protect the dignity and security of those documented. And on the other, make sure evidence is available to those who needed it for accountability, reconstruction, truth searching initiatives.
And how do you balance those? I imagine that to be quite a difficult decision in practice.
Yes, it is. So we are now working on our strategy because in the end, all the data that we collected belong to Ukrainian people. And this is their right to know the search. So at this moment, when the armed conflict is still ongoing, we work with the established groups that use information that could be accessed through our archive for their research accountability, legal action purposes. So mainly the well-established human rights groups or media organizations. But we're also working on a strategy on how to make our archive accessible to the broader audience in the future, making some data sets available, working on memorialization projects with another partners. So all these things we're trying to take into account. But at the moment, it's really an accountability-focused archive.
And the goals of the documentation work that you do center around supporting advocacy, research, and legal processes especially. How, sort of, if you look backwards from those goals, how do those shape your work and the nature of the archive?
It really shapes everything we do. We have also a research handbook that is our Bible, that guides our human rights, fact-finding research, legal and evidential research. And also, we also have a track 3, so-called the content moderation advocacy. And for example, if the goal is legal accountability, we need to make sure that the material can meet evidential standards at courts, which means careful metadata, chain of custody, and secure storage. If the goal is advocacy, we might use the same archive to identify trends, to highlight cases that can inform public debate and policy. So the way we collect, tag, and verify records is always guided by who will use them and for what purpose. So if the main purpose is accountability, we also consult with the in-house legal advisor and Kyiv-based legal advisor to make sure that we meet all the legal requirements, the national legislation, and the national legal framework.
Right. So as you collect the documentation, you already have a particular purpose in mind.
Yes.
And coming to sort of more closely to the topic of the podcast on Can the Record Be Trusted and the influence of digital tools and the rapid developments we've seen in that space over the last couple of years. What does this really incredibly fast evolution of digital tools mean for your work, and how do you use these types of tools? Has it changed your work at all?
Of course, we use digital tools for almost everything we do, from discovery to preservation, analysis, and sharing. Some are pretty boring. You might share search results of an email, but still very impactful with the email, like with a confidential sending code. Some are perhaps more novel, for example, auto-generating transcripts from readers and searching for words and phrases used. Some are useful, but also needed to record information about provenance, about handling. So purposefully develop digital tools play a role throughout the information lifecycle and create new opportunities while nature poses on challenges. Digital tools have changed our work profoundly. On the one hand, the sheer volume of digital content from the war in Ukraine is overwhelming. There's like millions of videos, images, and posts. Recently, we tried to convert the lengths of videos that were preserved within Ukrainian archive into years. And it looks that we have over 25 years of video recording. Wow. And with our digital tools like machine learning, image recognition, or automated archiving systems, that's just impossible to handle. And we'd also tried to team up with the academic community. Now we're part of the consortium of organizations, mainly research institutions from Norway and other Nordic countries, and also a few civil rights organizations. One is from Ukraine, another one is Mnemonic. We're building a consortium in order to explore generative ID in archiving purposes. So I try to be part of these processes, but to be part of the research community, having a lot of practical experience. So yes, on the one hand, these tools allow us to verify faster, map incidents, and connect evidence across platforms, but we also remain cautious. Technology helps, but human expertise and ethical judgment remain central to our work.
Right. So you always would have that sort of human oversight layer before, I guess, you use any AI produced results, for example.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why like all the work we produce is verified, done by our OSINT researchers, and we have like second to sometimes triple hope for AI principle. So there's a lot of verification, a lot of human labor involved in any analytical product that we use.
Right. And what are the main challenges you face in using these types of tools? And I imagine there's quite a few, sort of from both technical to societal and I don't know, maybe political even.
Well, being a political scientist, I have to say that for me, all these tools are still magic. So we have to rely a lot on our internal expertise, and we have a very strong tech team. So there's a lot of discussions, and we try to be very modest, and if there are something which is not well tested, we're not applying it in our practices. So there is information sharing. There are also other archival initiatives in Ukraine. For instance, there is a great local organization, the Trans Ukraine War Archive. So our management and tech teams exchange expertise, and also have a lot of discussions on the limitations and possibilities of new tools. I'm thinking that probably I'm not the best person to elaborate on all the nuances, but we try to be quite cautious about the dangers that it may bring also into our work.
And can you tell a bit about how, I guess, these digital interconnections and exchanges and new ways of granting access, how does it change how you can use and access documents, sort of rather than on the collection and analysis side?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the question?
Right. So I think you mentioned quite a bit already about how the availability of digital tools has changed. Sort of obviously you're collecting open source information or sending all of that. So the collection and analysis, but looking at the use and access side of the archives, how has that been changed by digital tools, or how do you use those tools for that?
So for the collection, it means that it could be done more systematically and quicker. So we can capture thousands of records every day. If just some months ago, our OSINT researchers, they had to manually collect the URLs and then like make this Excel sheets. Now it's much more faster. So now we can capture thousands of records and takes less time to be put into our archive. So analysis can also combine human rights expertise and big data methods. For example, spotting patterns of attacks across regions. Now we also try to do some cross-archival work. We're not just focusing on what's going on in Ukraine, but we're also looking at what we can learn from other archives. And recently, we started a project focusing on the role of Russian actors in Syria and in Ukraine. So we're going to have combined access and also grant access to researchers from Ukraine to Syrian archive and researchers from Syria to Ukrainian archive. So access is also about creating different levels of entry, from restricted access to investigators, to public reporting, visualization that can help wider audience understand what is happening. It also poses new questions in terms of how to manage scale, keep integrity, and enable collaboration in a responsible yet effective way. But it also provides new opportunities with regards to these questions in terms of how to standardize record collection at scale in a reproducible way, how to aggregate insights and have more effective search, and when holdings are not fully structured. It also provides new challenges for remote and differentiated access. But we're thinking of this together with our tech team and also with our partners, making sure that those who need to access the information they are looking for are provided with all necessary support, technical expertise, and legal expertise.
Right. That's a very interesting point about the standardization. Do you see sort of these new tools and the collaboration they enable driving standardization? Because I could also imagine that they would enable archives to become much more localized in their, in the description and in the, their own sort of set of standards that make sense in a local context.
Yes, I think there's a lot of sentencing standardization of the practices, but it's very difficult to do it in practice. So now we're just starting discussions with different archiving initiatives, those who are more sustainable, that have teams and years of experience behind, to think what could be done together. How the data is collected, how the data is preserved. Should we tag it or should we allow partners to do the tagging? So we are just at the very beginning of this process, and we're at the level of raising awareness about our partners that there is a need to standardize some practices. And also, we should involve into this discussion Ukrainian justice and accountability actors, because now there are a lot of legal barriers in terms of the use of open source information into trials. There is like lacking legislation on how information should be handled, how it should be stored, how it could be used in trials. So we are very at the very beginning of this discussion, but I think there is a growing awareness that with such a huge amount of information that being preserved under different archiving initiatives, there is a need to do it. And there is a need to share experience and to develop both theoretical approaches that could be done with the help of our partners within academic community and practical expertise, the ones that Monique has.
Just a last question to wrap it up, maybe. Where do you see things going, both as sort of the Ukraine archives, but also in terms of digital developments? Like, what are the big things on the horizon, the challenges and opportunities for you?
I think that, of course, we're going into the stage where artificial intelligence is going to be applied at different levels. And we're really happy to be part of this discussion with the research community that have lots of expertise and building projects now. Like, I'm really looking forward to getting the grant on the horizon together with other Nordic universities to test how AI could be used. At the same time, like, there are some set trends dictated by the donor community and the changes in the perception of accountability. So at least back in Ukraine, with their new trends, we could see that there is more emphasis on memorialization and use of open source data for keeping the collective memory rather than using it for accountability purposes. Because there is a big frustration in how their international systems work, how their international accountability framework is under threat at the moment. That's why I really believe that we can stick to our main mandate and use modern technology to advance accountability and justice, and at the same time, having a broader perspective how artificial intelligence and technological innovation could be used for advocacy, for preserving the memory of atrocities, and also for granting justice to the victims of atrocities, their family members, and their future generations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think with that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks for sharing your insights and your really interesting work, and best of luck for continuing this challenging work.
Thank you so much, Ulrike, for your interest in our work and for having me today.